And as the leader, as a mediator, your responsibility is to keep people moving. You want to keep folks in motion so that they don't stagnate at any part of that process with critical thinking. Hey y'all, welcome back to the Fast Forward Podcast. And I am closing out our conversation on conflict management by discussing three very important aspects of conflict management that, if mismanaged, can derail your conflict management. Those three are critical thinking, emotional intelligence, and charisma. I bring those three up because a lot of times we judge people's conflict management skill really off charisma. So if you're able to have the right tone, if you're able to be likable, if you're able to get people to laugh or smile, then you think, oh, that person is great. But when you have low emotional intelligence, no critical thinking skills, or very, immature critical thinking skills, you will do more harm than good. So let's break down, well, first of all, what is critical thinking? Now, this one, y'all, we need a lot more of that in this society. I ain't even gonna touch that. But I remember we had to take a critical thinking class in elementary school. So it was bookended with handwriting. So y'all know I'm dating myself now. One semester you took handwriting and you learned to write in cursive. The other semester you took critical thinking. And they would have us doing puzzles and brain teasers and word problems and all kind of stuff. And at the time it seemed silly. But to be honest, that was setting us up with the processes, right? The mental processes needed to do much more higher order skills and work later on in our education. And I still rely on things. So y'all know those little word games where it'll be like, Sally runs faster than Michael, but slower than Susie. Who comes in first? Right? Those types of problems. It could be if Johnny had five apples. If Johnny had five apples and he tasted what? Right. It was, again, just word problems and puzzles and teasers. But it was important, one, because it was like gamification and it made it fun for us as kids to build these very important skills and build our cognitive muscles and our cognitive rigor, right? To be able to sort through information. But it's really important because critical thinking has three components. First of all, you have to be able to assess information, right? Gather information. Then you have to be able to analyze it and then sort through it, categorize things. You can set stuff up, assign values to things, and then from there, synthesize what it is that you have gathered and analyzed to then make decisions. It is sequential. And it goes in a cycle, right? Because you might find in your analysis process that you got to go back to gathering and then you come back to analyze and then you can synthesize. But then, you might be like, hey, I actually need to go back and get some more. So this is a continuous loop. And what I find is that in conflict management, if you have not mastered how to navigate that loop, you will either create more conflict or, at the very least, let existing conflict languish. And that's a problem. As leaders, sometimes you'll have to help people navigate that loop. So if you find like that folks want to just keep talking about the same thing, you keep talking about what happened, they're stuck in that gathering stage. But the people who want to keep saying, well, why you do that? Well, I didn't like that. Why? Those are the people that are stuck in that analysis stage. And the people who want to keep tossing out ideas at the point where we need to make a decision about behavioral change, they're stuck on synthesis. And as the leader, as a mediator, your responsibility is to keep people moving. You want to keep folks in motion so that they don't stagnate at any part of that process with critical thinking. Another part of critical thinking that's very important besides continuous movement is recognizing the actors. I think, and I spoke about this in one of the earlier episodes when I talked about the roles that people play. But it's important to know who really is causing a conflict. And that's why I said you'll cycle between gather gathering an analysis a lot, like several times, probably because sometimes who is the clear actor? Like, let's say somebody get in an argument at the job and they just blow up on each other in a team meeting. So you pull folks to the side. I'm like, what the heck? It was those two that blew up, but it's really Sally Sue that's a third party that's been gassing it up for weeks and you didn't know that. And depending on how much power, privilege, or influence Sally Sue has, they might not even want to tell you at first. In fact, you might not even find out from them. You might find out about it and what Sally Sue did from a fourth person or even a fifth person. The gathering and analysis process is not only important for the two people in conflict, but it's also important for you as the mediator. Finally, synthesis. I love the concept of synthesis. And to be honest, if you want to understand more about critical thinking processes, Bloom's Taxonomy is a great resource for this. I know Bloom's Taxonomy, you know, it gets a lot of flack and it's an imperfect system, but I think it's a really good foundational tool for understanding the levels of learning and information processing that we go through, especially when you're trying to understand the process of critical thinking. But synthesis is a higher order thinking skill. Like, synthesis is not easy. You cross a lot of steps before you hit synthesis, and you have to master a lot of things before you can appropriately synthesize. Even as a leader, sometimes you'll miss it. And this is where understanding your bias as a leader becomes important. Because if somebody is your buddy or they have a long tenure or y'all went to the same school or they can always be counted on to get their work done and the other person's kind of iffy or you just don't like that other person, you'll inappropriately synthesize information in favor of the party that's actually wrong and mismanage the conflict. So I'll give you an example how this shows up. I had this job. This situation was crazy. This lady, who at one point was my supervisor, she basically had it out for me because she wanted me to be her pet. She got this role, was completely unqualified, but somebody sponsored her to get this, you know, high title job. She was in over her head. So when I started, she saw me as an easy lick, where it's like, okay, I'm gonna just get her to do my work, and then that's gonna make me look like the star. So she tried laying it on thick with praise with me at first. And then that kind of didn't work because the supervisor who sponsored her to be in this role, she ended up liking me and was putting me on projects by myself. She didn't like that because, again, she needed me to be her pet. So I found a way to get sponsorship from some other leaders to join other teams under this larger HR function. But the company itself was in such chaos before I could land into the other role. She still was my titled supervisor. And so somebody else started, this other Black lady, and she ended up hiring for people on her team. And I was trying to go, I should have just followed the first thing I was doing, which is to get on this other lady team and sit with that. But I didn't, because I was excited to get this other title and jumped ship with that. And the first shady lady, incompetent lady, got in cahoots with other Black lady, and they conspired almost to get me fired. And once their plot was exposed, because I mean, I'll tell that story another day, but it was like very, very, very dirty what they did. And I went to the person who technically was my supervisor at that point, like over both of us, and tried telling him what happened. And he was like, I can't believe she would act like that. Like, I've never seen her behave like that to anybody. Like, are you sure? And I'm like, no, this isn't a matter of personalities. And he was like, are you sure? I've never seen her act like that. And I'm like, this isn't a matter of personalities. These are actual behaviors that she did. Like, I'm telling you, they did this. And he could not believe it because he liked her. Because she knew how to play likable with the right people. And thankfully, this other random lady who ironically had just moved to this country, like this lady didn't even, it was nothing but God that kept me employed in this situation. And she moved me to her team. And when I explained to her what happened, she was like, this sounds so outrageous that it's like unbelievable. But she was like, I can see how emotional you are, and you just don't strike me as an emotional person. So she was like, I can't do nothing about what has happened before, but all I can do is try to help you for the rest of the time that you here on this contract. And she was like, let's just get this done. But she was like, I need you to be doing this because right now your reputation is like nothing. So this lady had pity on me and was like, yeah, just do what you can. And I ended up doing amazing on her team to the point where even like way after I left, they were still using what I came up with. And I just remembered how humiliating it was to not be believed when that person's behavior was so egregious. What that showed me was that when leaders are biased by likability or folks that feed their ego, they can cause irreparable damage to the whole team. And it was all just so unnecessary, right? It was just so unnecessary. And that leads to the second point, which is emotional intelligence. Because, and I know I've talked about emotional intelligence before, but emotional intelligence has five components. It's self-awareness, self-management, motivation, relational awareness, or reading a room, and then relationship management. As a leader, you have to strengthen your relational awareness skills. You have to. You don't have any other option. Because if you don't know how other people play on your ego, and if you don't recognize how other people play on your deficiencies, you will exacerbate conflicts among the team for no reason. And you might not mean to. That might not be your intention. You might not like it. You might feel bad about it, but that's what's happening. Folks shouldn't be able to play on you. So I tell a lot of my coaching clients, people shouldn't know your tails. Folks shouldn't be able to know, oh, if I pull this chain, if I do this, I know they're going to respond like this and then I'll get what I want. And we have to think about the overwhelming dynamics between a leader and their direct reports. Anyway, from birth, from early childhood, we are conditioned to seek to gain the favor and the approval of people in power. So we are geared toward paying attention to authority figures in order to figure out their next move so that we can navigate that social relationship safely. We first do it with our parents, our grandparents, other family members. We then do it among our neighborhood. We do it with authority figures in the community, teachers, the police, other folks, administrators at school. Then we start to do it at work, right? Like, we're conditioned to do this. Your direct reports are watching you. They know every Wednesday morning so-and-so, you know, got a late drop off for their kid and they're going to come in pissed. So I'm going to make sure I buy coffee every Wednesday. So I'm the first person that they talk to and I get to get my little, you know, lick in before everybody else gets a chance to talk to them. People know that. They're guessing that. They're calculating that. And so when folks know how to play on your ego and you have too many obvious tails, you can exacerbate conflict because all folks gonna do is pull that tail. They're gonna play on that tail and get their way. And they might be completely wrong. They might be completely wrong. The last thing I want to bring up with this is the idea of charisma. We love charisma. We are drawn to charisma. And it's funny because earlier this month I was talking about John Locke, and John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, you know, a lot of people in that set of thinkers around political theory, they talk a lot about government and leadership and social contracts and how we enter into these contracts with people based on the qualities that they share with us and that we value as a group. And one of the top things that we value in society, and this is across all political ideologies, races, ages, we love charisma. If you're likable and you got the right tone of voice, whatever that may be, you know, for men, it might be a deeper voice. For women, it might be a softer voice. If you are the right height, if you have the right quote unquote pedigree, you went to such and such schools, right? You had such and such career field. We love to trust people just based off of likability. We love the people who know when to smile versus when to look serious and when to point. Like, I remember learning about the points. It's funny because I did that instinctively, that, you know, political candidates, you don't point at people. That feels abrasive and rough, and it's a turnoff to voters. But doing this, that's why Bill Clinton was good at this. He would do this thing with the thumb, right? Because that felt more approachable. We love charisma, even if it completely lacks substance. So you got nothing going on behind those eyes. Or you could be a completely nefarious character. I mean, you out to get folks, literally. But if you charismatic, we'll let a lot of stuff slide. And the danger with over-prioritizing charisma is that not only does it exacerbate conflict, but it eliminates balance on teams and in groups, because the people who may be less charismatic but carry themselves with more substance and gravity, a lot of times they'll just leave. So in that example I gave of that job, I was looking to get out of there on the first thing smoking. Like, and I, again, one day I'll tell y'all the whole story of how I navigated out of that foolish. That situation was crazy. And I had some crazy situations at work, but that one was nuts. There was no way I would want to stay there. It was an insane experience, just absolutely outrageous. And a lot of really good people left and got out of there. So like, this type of dysfunction and chaos, I don't want to be a part of this mess. And you will find that everybody don't always tell you why they left. They won't always tell you why they're disgruntled. They won't always tell you why they don't want to be a part of things. And you lose out on that productivity, that performance, even the camaraderie, because people who bring the balance to just, again, overarching charisma, they don't want to be a part of the clown show because it's all an act. So what you have to do as a leader is say, how important is charisma to me? Like, is it worth it to over-prioritize charisma? What would it mean for me to lead people who, they not always silly, they not always fun, but they get work done? I mean, they like moving. They be, I mean, they own it. They just don't do a whole bunch of the kick in. What does it look like for you to be comfortable with that? Why are you uncomfortable with it? Did you come up in your early career where it was charisma over everything? And if so, how do you think that impacted you? How do you think that impacted your skill building, your relationship building, your sense of self, self-esteem? Because if it had a negative impact, okay, we need to work on that. We need to work on that. So that being said, again, critical thinking, charisma, emotional intelligence, those are important aspects of conflict management that, if not addressed as the leader, will result in you mismanaging conflict, exacerbating conflict, and quite possibly destroying your team. So what does it look like for you to address those three aspects? Which of the three do you feel you are the strongest in? Which of the three do you feel you struggle the most in, and why? Let me know down in the comments. And of course, be sure to like, share, and subscribe. And I'm going to catch you in the next one. Bye.